Welcome to the 76th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chapp.
And 165 years to the day of Frederick Grace's birthday, welcome to the podcast that's always celebrating the unsung heroes.
Freddie Grace, of course, we all know who he was, the youngest brother, I believe, of WG and his illustrious siblings, and reportedly the most elegant batsman in the family. And if not that that really stands for much, given that we don't have any video footage. You'd rather just have a strong average than looking elegant. Anyway, it's been a little while since we last recorded, and we've got a lot to cover. There have been test series happening all over the world, and we're going to be touching on some of those. There's been some controversy with the BBC Sports Personality of the Year, and I'm going to be delving into the archives to look at the history of that remarkable institution. And we're going to be reviewing the Cricket Monthly, which is a new online publication from Crickinfo. So Andy, what's caught your eyes over the last few weeks?
Well, as you said, there's been a huge amount of Test cricket on, and South Africa's series in India in many ways was a bit of a disappointment. It all ended up being a little bit one-sided, but I did very much enjoy the final Test. So with the series already lost, the Test victory out of reach, and South Africa finding themselves on yet another comically spin-friendly pitch in Delhi, they could have been forgiven for just getting things over with quickly, but instead they embarked on this epic blockathon in the second innings. Hashim Amla batted for almost 5 hours for 25. De Villiers batted for almost 6 hours for 44. You could not get further away from 2020 cricket or even attacking Test cricket, but it was absolutely gripping. And in one sense, it all felt a bit futile because, you know, as I said, the series was gone, and ultimately South Africa were to fall short and lose the Test anyway.
The interesting thing often about these situations is, I mean, you talk about the futility of it, and of course, in terms of actually turning the series on its head, it was never going to go anywhere. But what it does do, and I suppose England sort of showed this when they were playing against Pakistan earlier in the year as well, that sometimes you do just have to go out and you just have to say, actually, if that's how you want to play, then that's fine, because we can just grind you into attrition. Because actually, you know, it's not often the case that teams can do that. You talk about, you know, in this 2020 world. Well, actually, in this 2020 world, actually, you know, it's quite difficult to score, you know, bat for 244 balls to score 25. And so it does make a bit of a statement, doesn't it?
I think it's exactly right. I think South Africa needed to make a statement, not just to others, but to themselves. I mean, they'd really been beaten up pretty badly for three Test matches. And I think what Amla said afterwards, he said they needed to prove to themselves that they could actually compete in these difficult conditions. And I think in a way, as an England fan, it showed you that the South Africa team can't be taken lightly. I mean, I don't think we'd be taking them lightly anyway, but coming into this new series, that there's a lot of determination to them. You've been using your role as our Antipodean correspondent to look at a bowler who I'd sort of forgotten about. He'd very much gone off my radar.
Yeah, well, talking of brothers, Darren Patterson, of course, we all better know through his brother in some ways, but obviously Darren being the Australian leg of the family, as it were. Australia playing the West Indies at the moment, as we'll all know, hasn't been much of a series thus far. Sadly, the New Zealand-Australia series also turned out, with a few kind of sessions here and there as exceptions, to be a pretty one-sided affair too. But one sort of silver lining that's come out of the Australia-West Indies, so I was completely forgetting who they're playing for a moment, series thus far has been this. Both Darren Patterson's performance, taking 5 wickets in the second innings, but also more than that, the manner in which he took those wickets, because I think it's always very sad, and we saw it with Stephen Finn, particularly when a bowler sort of has their action tinkered with by sort of coaching staff and analysts who claim to know more about their action than they do themselves, and they say, oh no, you've been doing it wrong for years, you have to remodel your action. With Stephen Finn, we saw this, you know, ending very sadly with him having to go home from Australia last year, or indeed earlier this year. What was nice about Darren Patterson is that he basically, they've been trying to remodel his action for a while, and he basically said, blow this for a laugh, I'm just going to go out and bat and bowl exactly as I want to, exactly as I feel that my body needs to. And he came out at the end of the match and he says this, he says, it was frustrating because I changed my action and I didn't feel completely comfortable with it. And I think in the second innings, And I think in the second innings here, I just went, sorry, actually reading out a transcription of an interview is always quite difficult. And I think in the second innings here, I just went, stuff it really. I'm just going to go out and try and bowl like I used to bowl and just run in and bowl fast. And that's what he did. And often it's a great thing to see, you know, you just put aside all of the coaching and everything else and they just go out and they bowl and they get results.
I think it's a really interesting problem that a lot of coaches have. You need to add value, obviously, in some way. But actually, I think a lot of coaches obviously feel that the way they need to add value is this tinkering with technique. I suppose what's difficult is Pattinson is someone who's had injuries, you know, actually pretty serious injuries. And I just, in cases, but when coaches are tinkering, often they are, it's about the protection of the bowler. So I guess there is that defence as well.
Well, what was interesting there is that actually Pattinson came out and said he realised that the best way to get over those problems was just to put on a whole load of weight and kind of make himself into a more solid frame, because actually making himself slimmer and fitter apparently gave himself a higher chance of injury. So he's just gone out, he's just put on loads more weight, his body has naturally developed and he's been able to go back to the old way of bowling. And I mean, I suppose I'm not using this as a way to bash the bowling staff over the head with their twiddling, but simply as a good thing that he's actually managed to go back to his original technique and is being something that's worked.
So, away from, well, the joys of a fast bowler bowling as he should do, there's been a lot of furore this week in England over the ECB's seemingly lax punishment of Craig Overton, his abuse of Sussex's Pakistan-born all-rounder Ashar Zaidi. And the focus has really been on the fact that Overton got a two-match suspension. The Yorkshire captain was punished much more severely for his incident last year. They said very, very similar things. And I think incidents like this really sadden me as a cricket fan, because you think we all like to put cricket on a bit of a pedestal. We all like to think that actually there's a level of decorum on the pitch. There's a level of things that are kind of not said on a cricket pitch. And then incidents like this remind you that actually we're all being a little bit naive, you know, that actually our sport has as many problems, I think, with this sort of level of abuse. And I think in this case, the comment was something that, you know, it wasn't sledging. It went, you know, it was telling Zaidi to go back to his country in slightly more explicit terms than that. And it goes way beyond, you know, sledging or gamesmanship. And just a reminder that, you know, cricket's not above other sports in the way that we might like it to be.
And how has the ECB kind of reacted? How do you feel the ECB has reacted to this? Do you feel that the kind of punishment has been sort of proportionate and something that will be useful in terms of sort of highlighting this? Because I suppose one thing that is perhaps comforting, I mean, comforting is a ridiculous word to use around this at all, but is the fact that there has been such a furore around this. That, you know, almost, if it was happening every 2 minutes and it was kind of, oh, that just happens, and, you know, slap them on the wrist and fine them 50 quid. But actually the fact that, you know, people have got very, and rightly so, very aggrieved by this. Do you feel that the ECB has acted in the right way with the punishment?
Well, I think it does come down to this inequality where, so Yorkshire captain Andrew Gale was not only, I think he got a 4-game suspension, and also, so he used a very similar abusive comment towards a batsman whose name briefly eludes me, South African batsman, Ashwell Prince, and he was banned for 4 games, and the ECB also took the decision to not allow him to receive the trophy, which attracted real controversy. So Yorkshire, and the accusation that's been levelled at the ECB is they're protecting Craig Overton because he's a hot prospect, basically. They see him as they're kind of, whereas Andrew Gale was sort of a gnarled county pro, and they could kind of throw him to the dogs a bit. I mean, I take your point that maybe I'm being overly pessimistic, and you say, well, actually, these incidents are quite rare, and that when they are, you know, I think that's what's really hard to know. You know, you'd need to, you'd need a really honest disclosure from a few county cricketers to know how often this level of abuse is there. I think what is difficult about it is all these punishments feel a bit, you know, well, what is the appropriate punishment for racism? I guess, I mean, it all feels a bit.
And also, how do you divide between different types of racism? How do you say, oh, this slander is slightly worse than this, or something like that, you know, it becomes all a bit sort of pernickety in a way if you're just sort of, you know, racism is just wrong out and out, and actually, you know, saying, oh, well, this is something that was said by someone was slightly worse than something that was said by someone else. It seems to be too far into the semantics of it, whereas the bottom line, as you say, is just that it just needs to not exist in the game.
It does, yeah. And I think also this idea, yeah, is two games right, is four games right, it feels hard to make progress on that. Now you've been distressed by something that I've also been kind of deeply distressed by. It was something that I expected to go badly, but went even worse.
Even worse, yeah. So we, as regular listeners to the podcast will know, Andy has a kind of hope springs eternal attitude towards West Indian cricket, an attitude that is perhaps not borne out by the realities of the West Indian side. And I think because, you know, I kind of have a vested interest in the Australia-West Indies series a little bit as well, because I'm actually flying back from the UK to Australia in order to go to the SCG test. So I'd rather not, you know, fly across the world to go to, you know, 2 days of a one-sided match. But at the moment, it's looking a little bit like that. The writing sort of seemed to be on the wall after the warm-up game, when basically a group of Australian cricketers, many of whom hadn't actually made their first-class debuts yet, many of whom were under the age of 20, defeated basically the full West Indian side. And I think that made us all a little bit nervous, but I don't think anyone really expected that the Australians would demolish the West Indies by so much as an innings and 212 runs. And what this really, you know, this series so far has actually made me question in a way that I've never actually, I don't think, questioned another Test series, which is to ask, why on earth is this Test series being played? It actually benefit that it's being played? It doesn't benefit Australia, other than in the sense that, you know, their averages are getting a bit of a hike. It definitely doesn't benefit the West Indies, who are just being richly humiliated. It's not about, you know, blooding a young side or whatever. It's just total and utter humiliation. And actually, it also doesn't benefit the image of cricket to the public, where actually, you know, a good contest is the thing that actually draws in crowds, and something like this is completely off-putting to the, you know, fostering the game within Australia and indeed internationally.
But I think it's very easy to agree with you on that the West Indies aren't benefiting. But what is quite scary actually is that you think we're getting to the point where it is harder and harder to justify West Indies playing tests against the top nations right now.
Yeah, quite exactly.
And you think for those of us who were hoping that West Indies were going through a bad patch, the evidence is now overwhelming that it's a terminal decline.
Actually, you do wonder. I mean, this I've always been against the idea of a two-tier test nation structure. But actually, series like these actually make me think, would it actually be such a bad thing? Because really, what is Australia playing the West Indies ever going to benefit anyone, really? You know, occasionally, once every 15 years, they might miraculously win a test. But other than that, this can't be good for the West Indies.
I think the only way, and this again is putting on my hat of eternal optimism, is if this provokes a real backlash in the West Indies, because there have been false dawns, you know, there have been feelings of, you know, new captains, you know, Jason Holder, for example. I think he's a very, very credible young captain.
Absolutely.
A good cricketer and a good leader. But what no one seems to understand is you cannot turn to one young cricketer and expect him to turn around a system that is basically rotten.
Yep.
I mean, if there is a sufficient backlash that actually really goes for the governing body in the West Indies, maybe, you know, maybe this could provoke something positive. From the archives, and this episode, Toby will be telling us about the role cricket has played in the BBC Sports Personality of the Year award. And for our listeners who aren't familiar with this award, it's run by the BBC and has been run since 1954, and it is to reward both a really successful individual and more recently a really successful team in sport. There is an expert panel that gets it down to 10 individuals and then the public vote. And it is seen, I think, certainly within the UK, I don't think it has much prominence outside the UK. There's a big night, a big award ceremony. It generates quite a lot of discussion in the media.
So actually, it's something that, you know, usually passes me by, and that's as much as anything, because the kind of people who usually win are not the kind of sports people who I'm most interested in. Since 1954, 17 of the winners, so that a hugely large, a very large proportion of the winners have been from athletics, which isn't something I necessarily follow. But this year, it's caught my eye for a couple of reasons. One of which has been that, of course, there's been a lot of controversy over the nomination of the boxer Tyson Fury, who is a seems like a pretty odious character from what I can see of him, and you know, some various high profile figures have weighed in against his nomination. But there's also a noticeable omission this year, and that is, in an Ashes winning summer, the omission of any particular England player, and particularly this year, the omission of the batsman who became the number one batsman in the world, and also scored more runs in a calendar year than any other England batsman, and that, of course, is Joe Root. And just briefly, it's kind of a slightly ironic when you put some their sort of homophobic, sexist boxer Tyson Fury against the babyface batsman Joe Root. You kind of wonder who you want to be a role model for the next
It
generation.
is
But
funny,
any.
isn't it? Root is quite angelic. One thing I would say though, it was interesting because Root himself came out and commented that maybe while he actually was very modest and he said, you know, it could have been Stuart Broad nominated, it could have been Alistair Kirk. He did say it was a bit of a wake up call to English cricket. Although I did happen to notice that he did this while promoting his new biography. And there's one lesson you learn very quickly, that if a sports person says anything vaguely controversial, check whether they're promoting a book, because the relationship between the two is well, it's quite extraordinary.
Very good. And actually, Joe Root, completely off piste, but very briefly, Joe Root can be an amusing guy sometimes. There was some footage of the press conference after, I think, after England had won the Ashes, when him and Joe Root ended up probably having had a couple of beers in the dressing room, then doing a press conference and having a right old giggle about some particularly immature jokes. It's worth looking up on YouTube if you haven't seen that. Anyway, back to the sports personality of the year. And actually, so this prompted me to have a little delve into the archives and look, as Andy said, about the relationship between cricket and the sports personality of the year. Now, only four cricketers have ever won the award since 1954, and they are Jim Laker, first of all, in 1956, the spinner, David Steele, the batsman, in 1975, Ian Botham in 1981, and Freddie Flintoff in 2005. Now, of course, all of those have won during Ashes years. Freddie Flintoff and Ian Botham, you know, their heroics need no recalling and no introduction, and really they became kind of icons of those series, and even indeed kind of icons of those eras
I
of
think
cricket.
what's crucial to say about Botham and Flintoff, and why it's not surprising at all that they would win a vote that was about the general public rather than just the cricketing public, is that they really went far beyond the sport. They're both, you know, they were everymen, weren't they, who really the public as a whole could relate to. And I think you know, it's really interesting actually that it seems that you know, in their cases, you need to be a figure that transcends the sport.
Totally. Now, Jim Laker is one, obviously, who's going to be less familiar to us, given that he was mostly playing in the 1950s. Although, of course, he is famous for taking 19 wickets in a test against the Australians at Old Trafford. And that was the thing that precipitated him winning the BBC Sports Personality of the Year award. But the one who's really interesting on this list is, of course, David Steele, who to many people of our generation, I suspect, is actually completely unknown. He's not in any way a natural born hero. He was grey-haired even from a kind of youngish age. He was bespectacled. He famously was said to look more like a bank clerk than he did like a cricketer. And actually, he was distinguished as much as anything about the fact that he built his reputation and his career out of having absolutely no flamboyance whatsoever. So again, completely unlike a Botham and a Flintoff. The other thing that's interesting is that actually he won in a year when England actually didn't win the Ashes. There was an Ashes series, England didn't win it. The year before, England had been down under playing an Ashes series, and they got absolutely thrashed 4-1. The Australians came back to the came back to the UK, and in the first test of the England Ashes series, England lost. This England skipper Mike Dunnes was promptly sacked, and there was real feeling that this was, you know, the writing was on the wall for this season. And so entered David Steele, or well, he sort of tried to enter. He was at Lords, he made his debut, and famously he actually managed to not be able to find his way out onto the pitch. I mean, this is the kind of character we're talking about. You don't expect him to come along and save England. But save England he did, and he saved England by basically just batting and staying in against Dennis Lilly and Geoff Thompson, so a pretty ferocious Australian attack. And his figures aren't spectacular. He scores 365 runs in six innings, and you know that's a lot of runs. It's an average of 60 across those tests. But actually, what really makes him stand out is his kind of complete obduracy. And actually, thanks to Steele, England managed to draw the next two tests. So they'd lost the first. They managed to draw the next two. And actually, they had a chance to win the last game at Headingley. But that was the game in which the pitch was famously destroyed at the end. And I think going back to what you were saying, Andy, earlier about the idea of people capturing the imaginations of the public, what I think is really interesting about David Steele is he did exactly that. But he didn't do it by being this kind of either an everyman or a larger-than-life figure or Freddie Flintoff with his outlandish celebrations and things like that. He did it by just simply being a kind of completely obdurate batsman who just stood there and just defied in a sort of, I suppose, in a way, a slightly Brian Close way, but he didn't have the glamour of being hit on the head. He just defied the West Indies and just stonewalled for a few matches.
Yeah, but in a way, I think what makes Steele a very attractive figure is that Botham and Flintoff capture the public imagination through heroics, you know, really sort of dramatic moments of brilliance. Whereas I wonder if, in a way, it is very easy to fall for someone like Steele, who made his test debut very late. I think he was as old as 33 when he actually made his test debut. And for someone who came to the game late and showed, and I think maybe there's something that appeals to all of us about the idea of making the very most of the ability he had. You know, he obviously was not, he really was at the limits of his talent, but he was using that to hold off Lilly and Thompson. And you can actually see what, in a way, he's a classically British, it's the plucky underdog story, and I think the British public go for that again and again.
Well, and it was something that the British public particularly needed at that time, because actually, you know, there was very high inflation at the time, there were widespread redundancies, and there was pretty considerable social and financial and political unrest across the country at the time. And actually having a sort of a hero like that, and every man who became a hero, actually meant that cricket mattered. And I think what's interesting to kind of continually remember with this is that it's voted for by the public, that it's not actually, you know, a panel of analysts who are saying, oh, he had the best cover drive and he played this vital innings here because he didn't get out then or whatever. It's actually based very much on that sense of cricket mattering to a large body of people at any particular time. So that's a bit about the history, and I think that actually helps sort of inform the present and perhaps why Joe Root didn't get nominated. It's perhaps because cricket actually does struggle to matter anymore in the way that it did in 2005, or with Botham, or even with David Steele. So Root doesn't have the pedlo antics of Flintoff. He doesn't have this kind of anti-hero that Botham had, and he doesn't have the kind of curiosity factor that Steele did, this bespectacled bank clerk suddenly holding off the Aussies. And I think it's actually important to remember that when you look back through the history again of the Sports Personality of the Year, that of the 10 podium finishes, as it were, first, second or third in the awards that cricket has had, six of those have been either Flintoff or Botham. And actually, what is it that makes a hero in today's media landscape? And I think one of the things that makes a hero, and something it's kind of quite easy to come back to, but I think it's very important, is the fact that no longer are large numbers of people seeing cricket on terrestrial TV day in, day out. So actually the ability, all of those other winners won the award when their sport, when those Ashes series were being shown on terrestrial television. That's not something that Joe Root has.
And I think one of the other things, and this is a bizarre a bizarre consequence perhaps of England's success is that when England won the Ashes in 81 and when England won the Ashes in 2005, they were quite seismic events. I mean, it really, you know, they were seen as England reversing periods of Australian dominance. But actually, you know, not only did England win the Ashes this year, not in a way that the vast majority of the public could watch, but they also, it's felt a bit more routine. You know, England do win the Ashes at home, and it doesn't in itself now feel like as big a cause for celebration, perhaps, as it once did.
To the review. And for this episode, we have been reading the Cricket Monthly, ESPN's digital magazine, as it calls itself, at thecricketmonthly.com. Now, in order to sort of introduce this, I'm just going to shamelessly lift a paragraph from the opening editorial of the magazine that says this: in contrast to ESPN's topicality, the Cricket Monthly will aim at timelessness. It will run no match reports, news analyses, or columns on the month's big stories. Instead, it will zoom out to provide a panoramic view of cricket and its people. Profiles will seek to find the characters behind the PR-shaped images, interviews will be discursive, and every article will be allowed to grow to its natural length. Above all, it will be a showcase for fine writing and original ideas. And in doing all this, it will be the perfect complement to ESPN Cricinfo. So is it the perfect complement to ESPN Crick Info?
I've certainly enjoyed reading it. I've not really, before this December issue, properly settled down with an edition and worked my way through it. The whole concept is further proof of the resurgence of long-form sports journalism. So we've reviewed before on this podcast The Night Watchman. In other sports, I'm very fond of The Blizzard, which is a long-form football magazine that has had huge success. And the basic idea is that, oddly, actually, in this era of the internet, where we're supposed to be looking at everything, you know, very quickly on our phones, there actually seems to be a growing appetite for giving writers the opportunity to really go in depth on a topic in, you know, several thousand words as opposed to a blog post. And I think Crick Info should be commended for giving writers that outlet. Where I'm a little bit less clear is, as they note in that editorial, is this relationship between the website and a distinct magazine. Given the crossover between a lot of the writers, I'm not entirely clear what is gained by having it as a very separate concept, and why you couldn't just have it as part of the overall website. I mean, do you have a strong view?
Well,
on that?
I think they do. The two of them, they have succeeded in sort of curating two experiences that are a quite different feel. So if you're on the Crick Info website, that is all about sort of just bombarding you with, here's what's happening in the, you know, whatever minor league in India, and here's what's happening. You know, it's all the kind of latest stuff. It's a very rapid fire feed of information. And it's kind of what is latest is the thing that is featured almost. Whereas what I think is obviously, you know, the obvious distinction with the Cricket Monthly is something that is a bit more leisurely. It is something that is a bit more curated. Something that sort of combines content in a more thought through way. One of the things that I think it lacks compared to something like The Night Watchman, simply by virtue of the fact that it is purely an online resource. So The Night Watchman, if you download an edition, it still comes like the print edition. So that's what I have to do in Australia. Mine are still, my copies are piling up in Norfolk of the Night Watchman. But you download it and it's like a PDF basically, and you read through it. The thing about the Cricket Monthly is it is just a website. So actually, when you say you sat down and you read through a month's worth of stuff, actually it's not entirely possible to do that in the sense
no.
of just for the clarity of the listeners. What you're actually doing is just reading through all of the latest articles that have gone up there. And one of the things that I quite like about something like The Night Watchman is the sense that you do have a curated experience. What they're saying is that these 12 articles actually work together in terms of the range of their of what they're talking about and the way that they sort of support one another. And actually, I did, you know, still find, even though it is more curated than Crick Info, obviously, I did still find the experience of reading the Cricket Monthly a little bit kind of scattergun, in the sense that you're just faced with a whole load of articles. There they are, choosing what you want to read and don't go for the other ones, which I didn't find kind of entirely helpful, and perhaps is reflected in the kind of hit and miss nature of the content itself. So were you finding particular types of article that sort of worked for you and types that didn't?
Yeah, I think so. Crickinfo obviously has a very powerful draw. It is by far the most powerful media organisation within cricket by, several factors. And it does give it great access to top players. So in this December edition, we had really the headline interview with Stephen Smith. We had an interview with the Pathan brothers. And I think what I learned going through these features is something that I've kind of felt for a long time. It's very hard for interviews with current leading players to do a huge amount to me, for me, to be honest. I think as a journalist, you have to work incredibly hard to find new angles, and frankly, to get these players onto slightly uncharted territory. These guys have done so many interviews now, they've trotted out so many answers by rote, they're all pretty well media trained. I mean, I have not followed Stephen Smith's career any more closely than your average England fan, and I learned nothing really of substance in that whole interview. Which is not to say it wasn't well written, but it was more of the same. There was nothing that really illuminated his career for me.
Okay, so I think there's another thing there that you're kind of pointing towards, which is who this is possibly aimed at. Because I was pretty, so they have a little video sort of segment that is called Think You Know Yourself, where they get a high profile cricketer and basically they just ask them questions about stats in their career. There's one with the latest one is one with Ricky Ponting, and they ask him, questions like how many fast bowlers have got you out stumped, and how many World Cup matches have you won as captain? Facts that in and of themselves bear absolutely no interest to me whatsoever. I do not care in the slightest that Ricky Ponting has won 26 World Cup matches as captain rather than 20 as he himself thought. And what comes across really evidently in the interview is he really doesn't care either. And it's kind of, and but I started off by thinking, isn't this really disappointing? They've got this amazing access, but they haven't got sort of gone further with it as exactly as you say. But I wonder whether there is as well something that, and this is, at the risk of sounding incredibly kind of snobby in a way and a bit dismissive. I do wonder whether there is an audience actually for that kind of content, and whether maybe it is a good thing that, in the kind of ecosystem of journals that are out there, the Night Watchman perhaps goes for a niche that isn't accessible to a lot of people, whereas the Cricket Monthly is actually pointing itself towards a broader audience for the kind of long form cricket journalism, and maybe that's not a bad thing.
I agree. I mean, there's room for lots and lots of different, and I think we're living in a great age of cricket writing, actually. I mean, I think that there's so much good stuff going on. I mean, I think it's impossible to get away from the comparison between the two magazines. I mean, I like the fact that the Night Watchman, the cast of writers is a little bit more diverse. I think the Cricinfo writers are excellent, but they're actually a lot of the names that you're familiar with. I think the Night Watchman is a little bit braver in gambling on some interesting personalities from around the world of cricket. But I do think it's important to compliment that there are some great pieces here. Vitushan Hantaraja, who's formerly a guest on this podcast, is a very much Cricinfo's Surrey correspondent. And he has just done a really bit of good old-fashioned journalism, really going behind the scenes of Surrey's recent transformation, basically, from the kind of joke county who had loads of money, big-name players and no success, to winning the second division last year with a young and talented side. And what I really enjoyed about it is, I mean, I'm a sort of soft Surrey fan, having lived round the corner from the Oval for a while, and I learnt loads from this. I really did learn a huge amount about the way the personalities behind the team had been transformed, I think. As a curiosity, by the way, I had to mention the fact that Kumar Sangakkara arrived in London absolutely desperate to buy a houseboat, which is apparently a long-term dream of his. And also, if you didn't already love Sangakkara, who's just a wonderful gentleman as well as a player, a fantastic story about when Gary Wilson, he of Ireland fame, was captaining the side, and Sangakkara was in the slips. Sangakkara, of all these test matches, all this success, would ask Wilson's permission before he gave any instructions to the rest of the team, because he said he didn't want to undermine Wilson's authority as captain, which I thought was rather wonderful.
There we go. So despite what doubts we may have, I think, you know, the proof of these things is always in the content and the strength of the content. And I think, I mean, ditto, and I'm not going to run through a whole lot of articles that I enjoyed, but, you know, there is definitely content to enjoy there. So I think probably would it be fair to say that our message is that it's something that's worth browsing with a little bit of caution.
I think so, and I think also to commend Crick Info for the fact that they do have this really monopolistic position almost in cricket journalism, but they continue to use it, I think, in quite inventive and quite interesting ways.
Thank you for listening to the 76th episode of Reverse Web Radio. As we enter the silly season, we're not entirely sure when we're next going to be recording, but we wish you and your loved ones a very Merry Christmas.
If you have enjoyed the show, please tell a friend about it. Even get all social media savvy and share an episode on Facebook. Or if you'd like to discuss any of the issues raised with us or just shout abuse at us, at Reverse Swept on Twitter.